Wenn ich dein Triumph, Captivum Sovei Odinia, KJ mit in Exilio, Privatus die Filio, God day, Trium Diorum, Nos Gator pro te Odinia. Veni, veni, o Oriens, Solare nos aveniens, Noctis dispella nebulas, Dirasque noctis tenebras. God day, Trium Diorum, Noscator pro te Odinia.
Welcome to the Solar Storm. This is your host, Kyle Hunt, coming to you on RenegadeBroadcasting.com. Today's date is December 20th, 2015. Thank you so much for joining me here tonight. I have a returning guest tonight talking about the Yule tradition and some of her recent revelations. I have Shauna Fenner of Odinia International. Welcome to the show, Shauna.
Thank you for having me, Kyle.
Well, it's my pleasure. Now, I wanted to give something of a background to this holiday, a general overview. I know that you've gone into depth on some of these aspects on your own site and in your podcast as well. I did one exactly 2 years ago titled Yule and Thule. So if people want to get my take on it from 2 years ago, I really do recommend that podcast. And Lana and Henrik from Red Ice Creations have also done a podcast and also a video about this very same subject. So you might want to check those out as well. But tonight, Shauna, I would like you to give that overview, and then we're going to get into some very, very interesting revelations that you just recently came to, and it all makes a lot of sense to me. It has to do with the ornament on top of the tree. Not always seen these days, but not too long ago, this very interesting ornament and what its use was by our pagan ancestors. This is fascinating material, but we're not going to get to that yet. Let's stay focused on this winter solstice tradition and the Yule festival as a whole. How far back could we possibly date this? I don't know if there is a specific date, but it seems like a lot of the records have been destroyed and we're just left kind of in the dark about our pre-Christian past.
Well, you could probably take it back to the beginning of agriculture itself, which is difficult to gauge. A lot of what we know about early mankind seems to be going farther and farther back. You know, they keep discovering earlier and earlier instances of early man existing in one place or another that they weren't aware of before. So it's very, very difficult to gauge something like that. But we're probably talking maybe somewhere as much as 40,000 years, I would say. So it's certainly of much greater antiquity than this recent sort of Christian version of it that we see now.
Do you know when any of the kind of ornamentation of the Yule tradition started to come into things? The more Germanic traditions with the tree and the Yule log and some of the other aspects that we'll get into in here in a little bit.
Well, certainly that happened in different places at different times, but it was all over the world. That's one thing I can say that I'm fairly certain that I can say with some confidence is that it was in Egypt, it was in Rome, it was in Alexandria. You know, it may be that in some places they used different kinds of foliage. You know, in some places they might have used a palm, you know, garland, or, you know, a garland of a different variety of plant in Rome or something like that. But there were trees set up everywhere, you know, which is precisely what the, you know, is raved about in the Judeo-Christian Bible. It was the major mainstream European worldwide cultural celebration to celebrate, you know, the rebirth of the sun around this time of year, around the climax of the winter solstice. And it was in Egypt, certainly. You know, there was the same sort of holiday with the idea of bringing in branches. And this was, you know, considered to confer a blessing on the people of the household. And it was everywhere. And I think that one thing that's interesting is that it was in Northern Europe at the same time as it was in Egypt, where we can see that there was solar reckoning in Newgrange temple.
They also had a green man in both locations, Osiris being the resurrected green man in Egypt, and they both had megalithic structures. You were mentioning about Newgrange. Yes, could you please tell us about how this solar alignment is on this solstice day?
Well, it's a very impressive solar alignment, and it's kind of like the Irish counterpart of the Valley of the Kings. You know, it's a ritual area. It's an area that supposedly was also had you know, great ancestors who were buried there, and it has about 30 megalithic monuments in the immediate area, which is only about 4 kilometers, and it's a very mysterious site, really. I mean, it's the oldest of these sort of structures in the British Isles, and it has a lot of megalithic carvings on it, and many of them appear to be astronomical in nature, such as the spirals that you see, because that has to do with the movements of the sun going around in circles, you know. Well, it's actually, the sun isn't moving, but actually I'm talking more about our observation of the sun rather than actual the sun moving so much. I'm talking about from our observational standpoint, the idea that there are fixed stars and there are stars that move. And when people saw the sun coming up on the horizon, and this wonderful, awe-inspiring event happened where it suddenly stopped moving in one direction and started going back in the other. That was a matter of great importance, and it was a matter of great importance for agriculture as well, because it helped people tell when the seasons were happening, when the sun was going to come back, when it was, you know, it was changing from winter and moving towards summer. And it was very, very important for people's daily lives, and they were very much in touch with it at that time, much more so than we are today, perhaps. And these spirals that they have are representative of the movements of the stars. You know, clearly, I mean, I certainly think they are. I'm not the only one who thinks that, but...
What about the star on top of the tree? If the tree is to be representing the world tree, would that star on top, fixed atop the tree, not represent Polaris, perhaps?
I think that it represented the sun, probably.
Okay. I've also heard Sirius, too. So a lot of people have theories on this, and it's an interesting thing regardless. We also see an angel in place of that star, a female figure there. So maybe we could get into the goddess aspect of this solar festival as well.
I think that's also a representation of Sunna in that sense, perhaps. Although, you know, there's many other permutations of that, certainly, yes.
Well, we have Sunna there, but we also have some other women who play a crucial role in this story. We have Holda, who we could get into in a little bit, but we also have just the festival of Mother's Night to basically start everything off. Could you please tell us about this certain night and when it is celebrated?
Well, the solar the pattern that our ancestors had of observation of the sun, you know, such as the one we were just talking about in Newgrange, you know, which was so carefully aligned. I mean, the important part of that is it was, there's no way it was accidental. You know, they had the light, it arranged, they had the whole building arranged with a slanting floor. So it was a 62-foot long passageway, and they slanted the floor purposely so that the light could go down it and hit a particular important sarcophagus. And the idea was rebirth. The idea is that the sun gives life. And in a sense, of course, that's true. The sun does give life to the earth. So the solar ray during the solstice came through a sort of a high light box and then went down this slanted passageway and hit the stone basin. And if the passageway had not been specially slanted, it couldn't have hit the stone basin. So the whole floor, the passageway, was actually aligned just so that the sun could hit exactly where they wanted it to at exactly the right time.
I know we can't look into their minds to figure out why exactly they did this, but do you have any reason why they would go to all this trouble just to mark this day? Why was building such a huge structure so important to them to mark this? I think it has much more to do with than just building an elaborate calendar, don't you?
It has to do with life and rebirth. And the sun is not thought of only as giving life, but as part of a huge pattern of you know, cosmological sort of activity. So if you have a pattern for the sun, you have a pattern for the moon, and the lunar reckoning is very complex indeed compared to the solar reckoning. And people were examining these things, trying to find patterns in nature to help them live their lives. And they did, because these patterns, you know, told them when to bring their animals in. You know, they told them all sorts of things that helped them to live their practical everyday lives. But it was more than that, because they, you know, our ancestors all felt the spirit of nature. They were more connected to nature. And they realized that the idea of rebirth was seen in nature. And they applied that to their own lives and beliefs as well. And the sun has a cycle as well. And it, you know, it stopping dead like that and then turning around and coming back and becoming stronger with the summer, it is reminiscent, it's emblematic of that idea of being reborn.
Mm-hmm. Well, that, of course, ties us in to Mother's Night, which we were talking about before. Now, when this year, without getting too much into just how it is reckoned, when is Mother's Night going to be this year?
Well, it's going to be on the same – you can celebrate the holiday however you like, of course. You can celebrate it in a calendrical fashion. You can celebrate it in an astronomical fashion. But it's going to change every year slightly if you celebrate it in an astronomical fashion, depending upon when the solstice falls. So if you're going to celebrate it on...
That's a 22nd this year for most people, it seems.
Well, I'm in Hawaii here. So.
Oh, right. Yeah, but I looked it up for those of us listening. Those people listening in the United States and in Europe, it should be on the 22nd this year. I think it was the 21st last year, but I might be mistaken. So,
It might be the 21st this year. I think it's the 21st, but perhaps I was. I just sort of looked at something just recently, but I don't know. But the way it was celebrated. Is that, you know, if you remember, I was talking just a little bit earlier about how from an observational standpoint from Earth, if you look at the sun going up every morning, what you will see is that on the first day of the solstice, if you, let's say you have some very sophisticated astronomical markers, either ancient or modern, it's going to stop moving right and left across the horizon. You know, you will have been watching it for a season, and it'll be moving one way, you know, either north or south, depending on what season we're talking about, along the horizon. In that, every day it'll go a little bit farther in a particular direction. And then it will stop doing that for 3 days. And so that is the first day of the solstice. And the climax of the solstice that our ancestors celebrated, and that those of us who have some familiarity with astronomy celebrate still today, is, you know, when the quickening, you know, when the sun begins to move again, when it comes back to life again. It's no longer at a dead standstill. It's alive, and it's moving back gloriously in the other direction.
Coincidentally, December 25th, when we have another sun being born, right?
Well, yes, it's exactly. Yeah, there's no coincidence. They wanted to take our holiday. And, you know, people talk about a war on Christmas or something like that, or a war between Christians and pagans. But it's not really like that at all. What it was a takeover of religion, because Christianity had no content. So except for, you know, maybe some Jewish content, but it certainly had limited content because it wasn't even really Judaism. So
it actually spoke ill of the people who decorated their trees at this time of year.
Yes, but there were certain things they couldn't stop. And in fact, you know, in some sense, they didn't want to, because what they wanted to do was take over and superimpose their God on our tradition. So it was more of a takeover than a war, if you see what I'm saying.
While we're on this subject, I wanted just to mention that I find it very interesting that we have Christmas Eve, and I know that that is short for evening, but the mother god in the Christian religion is known as Eve. So we have Christmas Eve and also Mother's Night. I just find that to be another one of those interesting coincidences. Regardless, can we actually talk a little bit about how it seems that the female sun god of old, who still exists in the Germanic Sunna, it was replaced by a masculine sun god, and what the implications of this might be?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting thing to bring up. In our pagan past, we didn't really have this sort of antagonism towards one gender or another when it came to gods. It's very much a Semitic thing when you see somebody saying, okay, well, we're getting rid of all the female goddesses and anything that's female. You know, that's something that we see in the cultural attitudes of the Middle East among Semitic peoples. You know, that's a very Semitic thing. That's not something that's part of our culture originally.
Keep them wrapped in black, right?
Yeah, and covered up, and it's just not something that's part of our culture, but it has become part of our culture thanks to Christianity. So even though we're not the same race, you know, as the Semites who originated this Semitic patriarchy, I guess I'd call it.
Well, you know what's interesting, Shauna, is I see a lot of Christians who complain about the Muslim women, but look at what the religious Christian women do. Look at their habits, the nuns. What?
Yes, that's true.
They look very, very similar to a woman in a burqa, don't they?
Yeah, they do indeed, yeah. And it's in Judaism, too. The women in Judaism have this bizarre habit of they're supposed to cover up their hair on certain days, and they wear wigs, you know, and they cover their arms, you know. So this idea that somehow fertility is bad itself, you know, is bad.
Well, they're religious. Yeah, they're religious people. Their priests and their nuns are not allowed to display this fertility. They're not allowed to even have sex. Well, they recently have been having sex with non-reproductive sex with children, the priest, that is. So we have a very much a perversion of sexuality going on there. But it's just so indicative of this – this Semitic religion to take away all of the life-giving qualities and to turn them and pervert them.
You're so right. And when you mentioned that, the thing that occurred to me was when I was at Oxford, I remember going and listening to some very, very nice choirs at, I think it was Queen's College. I can't remember. Yeah, I think it was Queen's College. And you know, they were all little boys. And I thought, how unnatural that is. You know, they sound beautiful and they're really cute little kids. And I enjoyed it. But I thought, well, why aren't there any little girls or why aren't there any adult men and women? You know, wouldn't that be a little bit more interesting and create a more rich quality of sound even? But no, they wanted there to be little boys. And the idea was that the little boys were pure because they were before they became men, before their voices broke and they got low masculine voices. And I think that's kind of sick. I think it's kind of retrograde. That's because I'm a European person. That's my natural feeling on it. But for Semite, apparently that's really something that comes into their cultural traditions, you know, the idea of there's being something wrong with sex, there being something wrong with fertility, women as being associated with fertility and sex are evil and somehow lower than men. And even little boys, to some extent, are not considered as holy or as pure once they actually gain the age of sexual maturity and real masculinity.
Mm-hmm. Oh, they put them in dresses in that choir, and then the holy men themselves also wear their dresses. You know, these aren't battle dresses such as kilts or what the Spartans wore for performance reasons, and also it's quite comfortable not to be having to wear restrictive underwear or anything like that. But the point I'm getting at is that the feminization of men has been a big part of the Semitic takeover of the European people. Now let's talk about some of these manly men that we see in the Norse religion. It's not just, and actually just in general, our European pagan traditions. It's not just having goddesses celebrated. No, no, no. We have some very, very strong and wise and fertile men. Now, could you tell us about these 3 days we were discussing before when the sun seems to stand still and how that could tie in to what are commonly known as the three wise men today, but could also be known as the three kings and who those kings might be?
Well, there will be a lot about this. What you just asked in much more detail than probably, you know, since we're mentioning a lot of different things that we can go on here. But just in short, I will have this in an upcoming podcast, hopefully quite soon, if not next year, but hopefully this year. But this was a battle that was going on in the heavens. You know, the sun was dead. You know, the sun had to, there had to be a battle and the sun had to be reborn. And you know, it was a cosmic struggle, and you see that in all sorts of different ancient mythologies and legends having to do with this with the sun and its rebirth and heroes, and there's always heroes involved, and often they're struggling against some kind of giant cosmological beast of some kind or other. And this is also all over the world. This is in India, this is in ancient Greece, it's everywhere. And so our ancestors were very, very interested in these things. And so it entered into their popular culture, and being a very lyrical, poetic people, they made these beautiful metaphors about this cosmic battle, which, again, I'm going to talk about in great detail in this upcoming podcast for this. And so this was an idea of heroic struggles, and this is just exactly, precisely when we need our three great gods, Odin, Thor, and Frey, when we're having this great struggle, which is why it seems to me to be very likely that these holy, sacred nights, the Vinnóctin, are dedicated to them, probably one after the other, and that's why we in our particular organization celebrate it that way, because this was a masculine time. These were heroes and warriors who were struggling for the rebirth of the sun, for the vanquishing of this creature that had swallowed the sun, you know, in blackness, and for the rebirth of the light. And so that's what it's about. And then there's a celebration when the sun comes alive again, then it becomes a very female sort of holiday having to do with actual childbirth and rebirth and the sun goddess being reborn. And our particular Norse legends having to do with this and Germanic legends actually have to do with Little Red Riding Hood. And this is interesting because, you know, the wolf swallows the sun and then she's reborn. So that's what that's about.
I'm thinking of Red Riding Hood and just thinking of the Santa cap as well.
Suna is Little Red Riding Hood.
Interesting.
Suna is the way that our tradition survived in the face of Christianity, often in fairy tales and in legends and folklore. And Suna is Little Red Riding Hood, and the wolf swallows her. Her grandmother actually is swallowed, to be more precise, and she's reborn. And that is the basis of the Little Red Riding Hood story, at least that's my belief. I'm certain I'm correct about that, but
it seems we have the father time and, you know, the baby New Year being just a masculinized version of that as well.
Yeah, but it takes the heart out of it. The original is always the best, you know, because it's natural. It's born from what the people innately believe and feel and who they are.
a man is not going to be giving birth. Well, maybe in today's society, as we have transhumanism and sexual this and that, we'll be having Bruce Jenner giving birth in no time. So we'll change all that around. Could you tell us why the celebrations occur on night? Why is night more important than day? You'd think with a solar holiday that the daytime might be the time for a celebration. Why are the nights, like the 12 nights, which I'd like to get to next, so important during this time?
Well, you know, that's difficult to say with any certainty. I mean, I certainly, that's something I do not know precisely. I do know that sometimes it is hard to actually reckon at one time or other in such northerly regions, you know, when there is no sun in the winter. So my first guess would be that they were better able to see the moon in some place, for instance, such as Scandinavia. Or maybe even Scotland, in the far, far north, then they would be able to see the sun at that time of year, just simply because, you know, you have the midnight sun in the summer, but then you have the reverse of that in the winter. So the moon becomes your friend. you can see the moon better. And this is why they actually used amazing methods. Such as they actually had sunstones, which I have one myself. And the idea is that they can use polarized light that comes through the sunstone to show where the sun is. For instance, when they're on a ship and it's really important to know what direction you're going in, when they can't see the sun. So my guess is that in the winter in particular, the reason is that they couldn't see the sun sometimes.
They might have also been basing things off of the solar alignments. The astronomical alignments. So looking at the stars more so than the exact position of the sun.
So yes,
perhaps that's a good point. Something to do with it. Let's talk about the 12 nights. What are the 12 nights? Of Christmas now, but the 12 nights of Yule, when do they run from? And what is done on these nights?
Well, as I am sort of bringing up in my article that I have been posting around everywhere recently and sending to people, it's very, very common now for people to celebrate the 12 nights starting from the first day of the solstice, which for the reasons we were just mentioning, the idea of, you know, the quickening of the sun, the birth, the idea of the mother's night and the connection with birth. I'm very, very certain indeed that was on, you know, what usually falls around the 24th of December, which is the third night of the solstice, which is the climax of the solstice, when the sun begins to move again. So that's when the 12 nights begin, because the 12 nights are sort of moving through time. Movement is involved. And someone just asked about horses earlier. There were actually, there was the idea of mimicking the movement of the sun as well. There were actually, let me see if I can.
Well, right now I'm thinking of the horses that draw Apollo's chariot. With Thor, you have goats doing it as well. And I do know that there is a Yule goat. So perhaps that ties in. I also know Odin has Sleipnir, so perhaps that is one of the things being represented by this Yule horse. And also think about all the rocking horses people get traditionally on Christmas.
Well, the horse, it is connected to the sun in a sense. But what I was more talking about was the idea of mimicking the movement of the sun. Mimicking the movement as being a sort of a celebration of the sun coming back. There was a historic horse race in Germany in which 200 men raced on horseback three times around a church, and this was on the Yule. And it seems to me that this would originally have been a race that was run around a sacred tree or a sanctuary. And you notice that it's three times. This is the three sacred nights of the of the solstice, and to me that's significant. And you can probably imagine that in an ancient pagan temple sanctuary, such as the one at Uppsala, you would have had them racing around that sanctuary, and that was in sympathy with the sun. The sun was struggling to come back to birth. It was struggling to be born. And, there was a battle in the heavens, and there was a hero who was going to kill the woodsman in the story. For our Northern European people, kills the wolf that has swallowed the old sun, and the new sun is reborn. So
that woodsman is often seen more recently as Hearn the Hunter, and sometimes even as Cernunnos. As well to the Celtic people. And it seems that same woodsman would also be Odin, who slays the wolf at Ragnarok.
Well, there's a lot of different theories you could have about who the woodsman is. And I'm going to mention those in detail in that podcast I was talking about. But the idea of this horse race and going around the sun, or even of having the 12 days that you were just asking about, is reinforcement. You're sharing the sun's victory here on earth. You're emulating the battle in the heavens. You're mirroring the journey around the cosmic world tree, Yggdrasil. It's a sort of communion with the sun.
Well, and it seems that even our clock with the 12 hours, or the ruler with the 12 inches, or the 12 grades that you go through in education, or the 12 ounces, there are all these different 12s. The 12 disciples of Jesus are all representative of this this circle, such as also then, of course, the astrological signs of the zodiac.
Yes, and you can be sure that our ancestors had, all of these connotations in mind, because, as when I go into all this about Red Riding Hood and Suna, which hopefully I'll be able to finish that soon, you'll see just how incredibly metaphorical and lyrical our ancestors were, how beautiful the way they expressed things was. Comparison to today, where things don't have much depth and meaning generally. We sort of have a fast, shallow appreciation thing for things, not necessarily because it's our fault, but because we have people who are very busy and maybe perhaps working too many hours because of our situation with being slaves of the banks and things like that. Mm-hmm. And we don't have time to participate and recreate our own culture, you know, in the way we normally would have in the past. But yes, the 12 nights, you know, there would have been the connotation of the 12 constellations, certainly, you know, and the 12 seasons, and, you know, the, in Greece, certainly the 12 gods, and something similar with our Nordic deities, although we don't know for certain. But again, I mentioned some of that in the upcoming podcast too.
So we have a very plastic culture, as you mentioned, not very deep at all. And we have the Coca-Cola Santa that is given to us, the old, a little bit further back, Saint Nick. And some people will say that this is actually Saturn, you know, who celebrated Saturnalia. And that would make sense, you know, Saint Nick of time there. But we also have the Nordic traditions that could have this as Odin, who is the leader of the Wild Hunt, but also it seems it might have some elements of Thor to it, maybe an older Thor, because, well, look at the reindeer of Santa. You have Donner and Blitzen, and Donar is Thunor, it is Thor, and Blitzen means lightning, which is, of course, Thor's light is his weapon there. So what can you say about this figure that we see now in red and white and who it might actually represent?
Well, that's difficult to say. It's all become so mixed up. Yes, I think it's amazing, you know, that we still have Donner and Blitzen in Santa. And I think that certainly who Santa is a remembrance of our god Odin. And also, you know, in some, also Thor as well. In fact, there's probably more evidence for Thor than there is for Odin in the Wild Hunt itself.
Well, Thor is pulled by the goats. It seems to be very much related to the Yule goat as well, and the idea of Santa being pulled by the reindeer. Now, I've also heard people say that this red and white has to do with blood and the snow, but also about the mushroom, what is it called? The Amanita muscaria mushroom, which has a red cap that is speckled with white, and that it was actually a shamanic experience that was that would take place around these times when people would basically get very high on mushrooms or go on a psychedelic trip during this time. And these mushrooms should not be eaten directly. It would possibly kill a person to consume them, but they would go through other processes to be able to consume this psychedelic medicine of sorts, this drug. What do you think about this theory? Does it hold any weight? Can you find any evidence of it in the past?
Well, I know that these mushrooms that you mentioned are, you know, very often included in Yule decorations to this day. And I don't discount the idea that various substances were used in shamanic practices from time to time. But I think what people lose sight of is that the fact that our ancestors who had abilities to communicate with the gods or see the future or things like that, it's all very often pushed the idea that they had to use all these substances is pushed. But I personally don't believe that. I think that people either have such abilities or they don't. And yes, maybe they can be in some ways enhanced by some of these different substances, you know, that they talk about. I mean, I know they talk about the Delphic Pythia having possibly inhaled vapors from the earth before prophesying, but they don't really have any evidence for that. It's pure speculation. Often they try and present our ancestors as having used drugs, I think, various drugs like cannabis, for instance. and there is some evidence that there were, you know, there was lotus, there was cannabis, these different things around. But the idea that our ancestors who were involved in prophecy or priests or priestesses of the ancient pagan religions needed these substances to communicate with the gods, I think is a mistaken one.
I think so too, especially just seeing how people with such powers were persecuted when Christians had the reins. They very much went after the powerful psychic bloodline, or however you want to describe the people with powers, witches, as the Christians called them.
Well, yeah, and also anything that is unhealthy for our people is promoted. So, you know, the idea that somebody taking one of these substances occasionally for some ceremony may have happened, perhaps it did. But I don't think that people in general engaged in all of this recreational drug use lifestyle sort of thing that we see nowadays. I just don't believe that. Mm-hmm. They couldn't have gone about their daily business, the things that they did, have excelled in the way they did with that. And I'm just, you know, just speaking personally, with my particular life experience, having grown up in Miami and lived in Hawaii and seen so many people who are addicted to these things, it causes brain damage. And it's not healthy. I mean, yes, maybe sometimes it might help a person to enhance some ability temporarily in one way or another, but I don't think in general it's worth it for people to engage in that in the sense of it being a lifestyle, if you see what I'm saying.
We're often given the image of the Viking or just the Norseman in general, the Anglo-Saxon, as just being a filthy drunkard who was just getting wasted all of the time. This image is pushed quite a bit. Now, while imbibing and ceremonial drinking was important to them, Odin himself, or supposedly, said in the Havamal that one should not get too drunk. He very much warned against it.
Yes, and I can't remember the passage, but there's one instance where, you know, there were two women, and one of them was the nobility and one wasn't. And, of course, the one who was of the nobility didn't imbibe. So, you know, there's also the idea that a serious person doesn't do that sort of thing, or at least not to excess, as you were just saying. So,
right.
I do think that there may have been, you know, that there were some sort of, you know, drug use from time to time because people were experimenting or interested in such things. But I don't think it was a lifestyle. I really, really don't. From what I've seen just of people who do use drugs as a lifestyle, I can't believe it could have been.
Mm-hmm. Well, while we're on the topic of Odin somewhat, is Odin hanging from the tree represented by Jesus on the cross? Do you think that is a clear connection to make?
Well, certainly they probably did use that symbology, which was pre-existing, you know, the European idea, and perverted it to their own ends, just like everything else, you know. You take a pre-existing European tradition, and they did the same thing with the three kings, mm-hmm. as well. And not just in Europe, the Zoroastrians had priests or magi and in Iran. And you can actually see three kings represented in Byzantine art in Persian clothing. And one might imagine, it seems to me very likely that they started with them. You know, they had their three magi that they sort of made up and put in their story, basically, in order to take over that tradition of these Zoroastrians who were, you know, who were not as affected by Jewish religions yet. This was before they were Islamic. And then they took the same sort of tactic and took it to Northern Europe. And only in this case, it was far more outrageous what they did, because instead of just talking about priests or magi, they tried to pervert the tradition of our three gods themselves. And that's what I believe happened, because there really isn't any reference to three kings or anything like that in the Jewish Bible. The Holy Trinity is from our three gods, and it was a remembrance of our three gods, and it managed to survive by being sort of included in Christianity, but it was also degraded by being included in Christianity. And I want to take that, you know, level of degradation off and take out our real tradition again. Mm-hmm. And now, the interesting thing to me about that three gods motif is, where did you get the black, Asian, and white multicult, you know, three god thing? When did that start? And I've been looking into that a little bit. I think that's the first example of multiculturalism.
Well, when did that first start coming about? Do you know?
Well, I know it's pretty old. I mean, I don't know exactly. I've been trying to figure out exactly when it came about.
Well,
multiculturalism.
Well, with a Middle Eastern religion, you might imagine that one of those kings coming around might be a black guy. Who knows, you know? So, yeah, it's definitely not a northern tradition to have a black man coming to this sun god's birth, I don't think.
It's a contrived. It's contrived. It's sort of a pre-Jewish television media sort of historical contrived early example of Jewish-led manipulation and multiracialism, multiculturalism. I think it's probably one of the earliest examples.
Mm. Well, one question about the this concept of taking what's already there and making it kind of consolidating, assimilating it. Have you heard of the Celtic god Isis, who apparently had people sacrificed to him by having them hung on trees pierced by their spears?
I'm not really very familiar with that tradition.
Yeah, Isis, spelled just like Jesus without the J. And of course you hear about the a sacrifice being pierced by a spear in his side. Well, you have Jesus being pierced by Longinus' spear, and of course Odin being pierced by his own spear, being sacrificed to himself. There seems a pretty clear connection there to me. How about we go on and just kind of talk about Judaism as this Borg entity? Now, we have the Borg in Star Trek being represented as traveling around in a big cube. Now, you have the Jews wearing cubes on their foreheads and on their arms, and we have the Muslims circling around a cube in Mecca. And tying it just a little bit more of the pop culture, you have the Transformers, these machines being brought to the earth in a cube, the AllSpark. And we, of course, have Mecca there as where the cube is. And now you just think about mechanized, these machine men circling around, mechanized. Isn't that interesting? And one final tie-in before I throw it over to you about this Borg assimilation of our cultures. What about the another pop culture reference? We have Loki getting access of the cube in his quest for world domination in the terrible recent Thor movies.
Well, I think that Jews often insert things that they're thinking about into the movies they make. But yes, there's this, it's kind of like a termites, you know, they come and they break down the existing traditions. They break down the identity of the people whose lands they have infiltrated or invaded, depending on what they're doing at the time. And then they proceed to try and take away their knowledge and take away their loyalty to their own folk, which is a huge problem with Christianity. I mean, I even see people who are supposedly white nationalists who really, truly hate our European traditions, and they really do think that our own gods and our own traditions are evil, simply because a Jew told them to. You know, the Jewish Bible, that's just one book, that's just one source, and it is foreign. It is Jewish. It's not European. So you have to make this basic decision. This is what I always ask people. I say, you know, you have to consider your source. Which source do you consider more valuable? Do you consider the source of, you know, a tribe of con artists who have been thrown out of countries more than 100 times? I think it's about 109 times that we know of.
Let's make it 110.
To be a good source. I mean, these are people who we know in history to have been hated by ancient Europeans. I mean, Romans talked about them being hated by all men. These are our, you know, European ancestors or tribal relatives, depending on where you're from in Europe. You know, identifying these people as, you know, very, very bad people, very dishonorable people. We see it in their own Bible that they wrote. We see that they, you know, marry their half-sister and they pride themselves on cheating people. And we see Moses is an infiltrator. Mm. He infiltrates, you know, Egypt. So all, you know, they pride themselves on being dishonorable. And then you contrast that with European people who we may not be perfect, but in especially in more ancient times, we prided ourselves on honor and dignity and, you know, real worth and meritocracy as opposed to Semitic patriarchy or Jewish feminism and matriarchy or anything like that. Yeah, it was meritocracy.
We really had pride and courage and honesty and being a man of one's word, keeping their oaths. This was very, very important. And now this is not how the Jew operates. And this is how I think the Jew has been successful, as he's exploited our honorable nature and subverted us that way. Now, let's talk just a little bit more about the tradition of Yule before we take a short break and then get on to your very, very interesting revelations that relate to this holiday. Now, before I ask you one more question before we go to that music break, just bringing up a few things in the chat. We've got Janny saying that it's not the Borg entity. The Jew version is the Berg entity. And you know, thinking about the Berg, you know, and the kind of the city, that does make sense. The city is the realm of the Jew, and very much the Jew has benefited from taking us out of our natural environment and bringing us to these city environments, whether or not it's suburbs or, you know, literally in the city, in the urban jungle. We've got also somebody saying, oh, yeah, it's not the it's not actually the Borg who are the Jews on Star Trek. It's the Ferengi. I don't know if you ever watched Star Trek, yeah. But the Ferengi are definitely Jew-like. So maybe we've got multiple Jews.
Deep Space Nine, Ferengi.
Yeah, different.
Ferengis have a bunch of rules that are very much like the Talmud.
Yeah, well, I think we see the Jews represented in different ways, in different characters and different groups throughout popular culture. Not even though they control the media, the Jewish type characters are not always favorable, such as in the Star Wars, not this one that has the black hero, but the ones that were done the prequels. You had the Jewish slave trader, you know, an alien slave trader who's selling Anakin's mother around. Yeah, that definitely was a Jewish character there, and very accurate as a slave trader. But what I wanted to get your opinion on before we move on to the song and then this very important topic about the lightning and the sun and lightning rods, which we will get to. I wanted to talk just a little bit about Holda. We had mentioned the female element of this holiday, and Holda seems to be a very important part that I think a lot of people have not yet heard about, and she and her followers were demonized as witches.
Well, they were very concerned with demonizing Holda in particular because she was such an important goddess and so central to the hearth and the home and to the hearts of people. You know, she was a mother goddess. And very, very close to us. And that is why they hated her so very much. And also because I guess she was female. But the importance of her, you know, the inability of people to separate themselves from her, because she's a part of us, you know, she's our ancestral goddess, is something that they couldn't really fight against, you know, very easily. So they had to engage in really extreme demonization tactics about it and make her into an evil witch. And they did the same thing with the Valkyries, even, you know, the beautiful Valkyries are evil witches, and Hulda is an evil witch. And of course, anybody who follows Hulda is also, in our own culture and our ancestors in general, are, you know, evil, and because they're pagan. And it's all just basically anti-Europeanism cloaked in fake religion. You know, what's underneath it all is just a corrosive battery acid of European, hatred and envy of European culture, which they are trying to make us hate our own culture. And our own gods and goddesses, and they're also trying to belittle them, like, you know, that they do with the Thor, making Thor a female, and, you know, the Thor, the symbol of masculine power, you know, making him into a female. It's an insult, you know, and it's meant to be, and we're meant to tolerate it, you know, be forced to tolerate it, we're supposed to participate in our own degradation. You know, for instance, the baby baby Hitler thing recently. Do you remember that? They had this New York Times article with would you go back in time if you had a time machine and kill baby Hitler? And there were all these politicians, male, you know, white European politicians, who were saying, yes, of course I would go back and kill baby Hitler, and, you know, crawling on their knees. And, you know, Jews just love that. And it also, they think that provides an example for the other, what they think of as goyim cattle, to take this. We're supposed to think that's normal. They're supposed to think that's the consensus, that everybody would go back in time and kill our own people for Jews. When actually all those people in Germany were doing, were trying to protect themselves from Jews and expel them, despite all the hype and lies about the Holo hoax. So that's interesting, because, you know, my response to that was saying, you know, what would really solve the problem is to go back in time and castrate baby Abraham. and that was actually very, very popular with people, that yep. idea.
So. We need Saturn's sigh to go and castrate baby Abraham, just like he did with Kronos, so we can stop birthing these monsters. We've got Bluten Bowden in the chat saying that Frau, I don't know how to say this actually, it's Holle, so it could be
Hola.
Yeah. It leads the wild hunt in Pennsylvania Dutch folklore. And of course, Dutch is not actually referencing the people from Netherlands, but the Deutsch, the Germans who then settled mm-hmm. in Pennsylvania. So that is very interesting, how she is actually the one who leads the wild hunt in their folklore. And that does make me think of also Holly, just the way that it's spelled, Holle. Holly, which obviously has a connection to the season as well.
Well, Frau Hulda, or Hola, she's an elemental goddess of winter, and you know, there were many different gods and goddesses who were perceived as being leading or participating in the wild hunt. It wasn't just Odin. In fact, there's a Frenchman who's written an academic book about it, who says, well, Odin is the one person who wasn't included. And I personally don't agree with him, because there's such there's a pretty far, you know, a pretty strong popular culture component that does include Odin, that I think must be based on something. So I don't agree with him that Odin wasn't included. I think Odin was. But there are many different participants in the wild hunt, not just Odin.
Well, Thor leads it sometimes too, doesn't he?
Yeah, and even again, as far away as India, there's traditions of the wild hunt. So it's a very, very ancient belief.
that are ancestral heroes and warriors, those who are dead. And also occasionally, you know, they would sometimes have somebody living that they would take along with them as well. It's a very old tradition.
Very interesting.
Just ancient beyond all, you know, imagining. We probably can't even fully comprehend how ancient it is.
Well, Shauna, please go continue with that.
No. We were about to have our break.
Let's take that break. And then when we come back, we can wrap up anything else that you'd like to add to this line of thinking. And then we'll get into your recent revelations that have come up on Odinia.org, which I think are spot on. And the song we're going to be going to hear, just so folks know, and they probably could tell, is going to be from you. This was part of your Wild Hunt podcast that you did 2 years ago. The first song that people heard coming in was also done by you. And this is the second, the one that ends out your podcast that you did a couple of years ago. Anything you'd like to say about this song or the first one before we hear it?
The first one is interesting because it talks about rebirth and the depths and darkness of the tomb, and it's so very solar. And that's the really nice thing about some of the Yule carols that we have. It's obvious that some of them are very, very much un-Christian. they're based, such as the Holly and the Ivy, for instance. They're based on our own traditions, you know, our real European traditions. And that is definitely one of them, even though, on the surface of it, it does make reference to the Jewish God, the idea of the tomb and the solar connotations that are all very much pagan are all still there. And it's the same with this one that you're about to hear, Noël Nouvelet, I think you're talking about, right?
Correct.
Yeah. You even have it talks about a flower, and, you know, the flower of the winter is the snowflake, I think. It's a very beautiful lyrical sort of song. If you look at what the lyrics actually mean on both of them, they're very beautiful.
Fantastic. Well, we'll hear that one in just a second here, and then we'll come back and we'll hear about your recent revelations, and also we could take some calls heading into the second hour, so I'll give out that phone number when we come back. So enjoy, folks.
Noël Nouvelet, Noël chantons ici, des votés j'aurai dans du merci. Chantons Noël pour le roi nouvel. Noël nouvel, Noël chantons ici. Kwame es vilou et juste assez dormi. Ouvre mes yeux, un arbre fleuri, dont il sait un bouton vert émélu. Noël nouvelle, Noël chantons ici. Quand j'ai le vie, mon cœur fut réjoui, car grand clarté resplendissant de lui, comme le soleil qui loue à matinée. Noël nouvelle, Noël chantons ici. We ask that our high ones and our ancestors rejoice with us in the majesty of nature, so that we may fully sense the mystery and wonder of this season.
and feel in our hearts the spirit of truth that has been denied to us so long. May you enjoy all the glorious beauty of the Yuletide, from its deep and heavenly darkness and glowing night to the shining brightness of dawn. Vasil.
Welcome back to the Solar Storm. This is your host, Kyle Hunt, and tonight, my guest right here on RenegadeBroadcasting.com is Shauna Fenner. Still hearing some of these birds here. Yeah. We'll quiet them down. Shauna, can you tell us what you have recently discovered? This is something that is quite incredible, in my opinion.
Well, I found it very fascinating myself. It's a very odd way that I came upon this discovery. I saw a rune that is associated with Thor, and that made me think of swastikas. And I was looking for swastika ornaments, just to summarize this briefly, and saw some that were accompanied with tree toppers and realized I needed to get one. And then I saw this, and this was on Thor's day, and it was a rune associated with Thor. And so it was all very much about Thor. And I saw this tree topper, and I realized what it was the moment I saw it. I hadn't seen one in many, many years since I was a small child. And when I saw it, I understood that it was a symbol of Thor too, but that it was more than a symbol, that it was also a actual practical part of ancient pagan temples, and that it is in fact a lightning rod. And I believe that they were on ancient Yule trees as well. I mean, not just Yule trees, but that our ancient sacred trees would have had also had lightning protection of this kind. Grounded, you know, I actually found everything I looked at, you know, I thought, oh my gosh, it made so many things fit that it was amazing to me. And then everything that I checked out. And then I thought of the golden chain that is on the Temple of Uppsala, or that was once long ago, according to Adam of Bremen's account of the temple, around the great temple at Uppsala. There was a giant golden chain, and that's part of the lightning system for the ancient temple as well. And I found all sorts of references to a rediscovery of it, for instance, by a man in what's now the Czech Republic, who also used a chain as part of the grounding mechanism, using, you know, the lightning rod, with the spires, the church spires. Now they are, but in the past they probably would have been more pagan in appearance, but they're exactly the same form as a lightning rod, as a modern lightning rod. And the same methods are used today and have been rediscovered in more recent times. And the chain was used during the rediscovery as well for a church, you know, another religious building. So it all seems to fit. So I think that these ornaments, these tree toppers that you see, are remembrances of our lightning rods. It was a way for our people to keep our traditions alive.
And, of course, some people who are listening might remember putting together paper chains, taping a little circle of paper connected to another circle of paper, and so on, that forms a chain going all the way up the tree as garland. And apparently this was used to protect not only Christmas trees out there living in the wild, not Christmas trees, Yule trees, of course, is what I'm talking about, the evergreens, but also oaks, as you mentioned, specifically the Donar's oak, Thor's oak, because this specific oak was the tree that is most struck by lightning. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. Yeah, I think that the reason was because I actually looked up the scientific reason for it once. I believe it was because it has more water in it than other trees, or it was more porous, or something along those lines. but definitely it's the most struck tree, according to our modern science. So this was, you know, it's Thor's tree. It's the Donner Oak. Of course, the tree at the Temple of Uppsala probably was, you know, was not an oak. But this, you know, our people loved our sacred trees. And certainly, you know, the rituals that we would have had outside around an oak or other sacred tree were just as important to us as ones that were within temples. And we did have temples as well. And the chains that you see in the historical, you know, accounts and our modern Yule decorations are reminiscent of that, clearly. I mean, I didn't know. I did the same thing that you did when I was a little child in, I think it was in elementary school or something. I put together those same paper chains, and now I realize what they are. I only realized what they were last night. I added that to my article last, the paper chains. But they're an actual members of something that was real 1,000 years ago. And all this time, it's been lost because of Christianity, because it was repressed. The meaning and the actual effective use of this was repressed, and we must have done this because we loved our sacred trees so much, and we wanted to attract lightning, because we it had to do with Thor and fertility, but at the same time we wanted to protect our trees and buildings as well, and that's why we had the trees decorated with the metal and the chains and the gold and silver, and it does work. There's a man who does it now. I found a video about it that I put in the article.
Now, you mentioned in the article that at the time that this was being rediscovered, the Christians just saw it as devil science until some of their buildings or their trees were struck by lightning. And then they said, wait a second. Actually, could you install those? Because, you know, I guess this Thor god doesn't like what we're doing here.
Yeah, this poor man, this Czech man whose name I think it would be very difficult to pronounce. Let me see if I can even. But he was obviously a very, very gifted inventor. And although I doubt he had access to it himself, he was quite a genius. He may have had some ancient record that we don't know of, you know, that had to do with this that no longer exists. But I think he probably just independently, the likelihood is he independently invented this what he called a weather machine, and he tried very hard to promote it. He even, went to the emperor of Austria and tried to get him interested in the project, and but it was considered so evil, and the committee that the emperor Ferdinand I of Austria sent this proposal to turned it down, because they didn't want any of these infernal devices that controlled the weather, which everyone knows was, of course, evil spirits caused, you know, storms, not anything else. So, and one of the mathematicians had the courage to talk about how ignorant they were. He said that they contemn what they do not understand, which is very much relevant to our modern world and to Christianity and cultural Marxism and the effects it has upon us. We have a situation where people don't understand something and they condemn it, maybe partly out of just sheer laziness about not wanting to figure it out, but also because people fear what they don't understand, and they fear the idea of excelling in excellence and dealing with things sometimes for whatever reason. And that is a very retrograde cultural Marxist point of view. It's better to want to succeed and triumph and over challenges, and that's the whole basis of the struggle between Christianity and our ancient Odinist religion. You know, the idea of wanting to win by being sacrificed and sacrificing your people and just obeying this Jewish God, and the idea of having a cosmic battle that you win for yourself and your people, that you're gloriously triumphant. And we're supposed to think there's something wrong with that, but there isn't. That's a good thing.
Well, so, I do think that there is something to be learned from, just mythology about sacrificing for one's people. For example, Tyr, otherwise known as Two, of Tuesday, he sacrificed his hand
to
the wolf so as to prolong Ragnarok and give the people more time to prepare and the gods. And so I think that we can see how people have sacrificed for us throughout time and how the gods even have sacrificed for us and learned from that. But it does not need to be a defeatist type of sacrifice. It can be a victorious sacrifice, one that is something very positive and productive. Because if we look at the fruits of Jesus' sacrifice, what did he sacrifice for? Look at the world since then, how awful and destitute and depraved and disgusting it has become. He came to save us from wickedness. What has happened since then?
Well, there's a lot of people who think they aren't communists, but they are. You know, there really is a hatred of excellence and achievement that has become, that has permeated our society so much. And I really do think that the Christianity has been one of the greatest tools used to do this, but they don't really need that anymore. They've got the cultural Marxism going even without Christianity, but still, it does still seem to be one of the forerunners. And I see so many people who are anti-merit, you know, and really it's in some ways this battle that we see in the modern world. It is not just, you know, a lot of people think it's about race, and it is, but at the same time, it's about IQ. And we have a problem where people with high IQs, instead of saying, okay, well, they accomplished something for me. Look, they built that weather machine for me, like this Czech inventor did. And it's wonderful. It's keeping lightning from hitting me when I'm this building. And it's fantastic, and I appreciate it. That's great. Let's build some more, you know, which would be a normal, healthy sort of reaction. You know, as you mentioned, these people actually tore his machine apart, and then only when their vineyards and fields and everything were destroyed because the lightning hadn't been directed to the lightning rod, did they ask him to build it again. So we have a society. There's nothing wrong with self-sacrifice, as you were saying. Sometimes self-sacrifice for your tribe is necessary and very honorable and noble as well. But the idea of sacrificing yourself for the sake of a foreign god, you know, and putting that god before your people, that's not a positive thing for any people.
Oh, or sacrificing your child, as Yahweh himself did, and as he commanded Abraham to do, and just staying his hand at the last moment. I really felt like that, if that even happened in any kind of historical way, that was just a test to see which bloodline should be chosen, which one could be most easily psychologically controlled or psychically controlled by this Yahweh God to commit his evil or just depraved and disgusting and immoral deeds upon this earth, to infect it with his seed. It is just such it is so antithetical what Abraham and his tribe were really all about to the European ways. And you just compare the holidays, the holy days of the Jews as compared to the European people, and you see it in stark contrast, where the Jews are always celebrating their genocide of another tribe for this holiday, the Festival of Lights. You have Hanukkah being their conquest of the Greeks, the slaughter of the Greeks. But you've got Purim and other holidays as well, where it's just about how they're dominating other people and their celebration of their genocide and their ethnic cohesion. Whereas with the European people, yes, there's the element of ethnic cohesion and good cheer amongst you and your folk. Unfortunately, that has been subverted these days. It is primarily a celebration of life, even when the sun, the life-giving sun, is at its very least, it is looking on the bright side of things. You know, you could look at the Harvest Festival, or even, as we discussed, Samhain on the last time, in the Day of the Dead. Even when we're talking about the Day of the Dead, we're talking about them recognizing its connection to life and making that such a primary focus.
Yeah, the Hebrew holidays, they're sort of single-minded, aren't they? I mean, I'm trying to think of I mean, I'm not an expert on Hebrew holidays. I did actually once attend a Purim service in Miami because I had a I was invited to do so by a Jewish belly dancer I knew. I used to be very much involved in Middle Eastern dancing a long time ago. And I went to the ceremony and it was fascinating. You know, it's very negative, as you say. It's also very simplistic. I mean, so many of their holidays are, it's almost kind of pitiful in a way. They take these rattles in, you know, it's all sort of about dietary restrictions and stuff. And they're trying to make that into religion. It's not really, it doesn't really have any depth to it. From the European standpoint, it's very limited. And that's why it's so bizarre the way they're trying to get us to actually stop celebrating our own holidays. For instance, there's this Rabbi Lawrence Kellerman. I'm looking at this article I wrote a few years ago, who actually, you know, he writes this huge spiel about how celebrating, he likens celebrating Christmas to celebrating Hitler, to being Hitler Day. And not that, there would be anything wrong with having Hitler Day, in my opinion, but
we could celebrate that on another day. That we've got April 20th. We can use that one.
Well, there was some sort of Satanist who was writing an article on that, saying we're never going to have a Hitler bloat in paganism. Well, he's wrong. I've already had a Hitler bloat. So so there you go. Anything can happen.
Let's talk about this just for one moment, because it's such an interesting subject. Adolf Hitler, you have him leading the country, the nation rather, in the accurate definition of the word, the nation that revives the Germanic symbols. It brings back the runes that were once upon a time a death penalty if it was found out that you're using runes. You have these runes emblazoned upon a proud Aryan folk who had a significant element that were bringing back the old ways. Some will argue that Christianity was the religion of Hitler and most of the top National Socialists, but there is a compelling argument to be made, especially when certain questionable texts like the Table Talks are considered, that Hitler himself was not a Christian, but in fact very much into the ancient pre-Christian ways, much like Heinrich Himmler. What do you think about this?
Well, I think there's very strong reason to believe that's the case. There was a Table Talk book that was fake, but as far as we're aware, it certainly seems very genuine. The 1941 to 1944 Table Talk. If one looks at that, it seems pretty clear that Hitler did not actually think that Christianity was very positive for people in many ways. I mean, I think that he supported freedom of religion, though, And I wouldn't say that he had, because after we'll think about this, we all started out, many of us started out being forced into Christianity, and everybody moves at their own pace and has their own deprogramming schedule. And Hitler had his too. And certainly it would be better for him and all of the rest of us if he and everybody else in Europe and America had been an Odinist like Arminius, in which case there wouldn't have been a war in the first place, because no Europeans would have fought each other for the sake of Jews who were telling lies and controlling their banking system in that case.
He wasn't going to wage a war against the Christians who were his kin. He wouldn't do that in general, but he had higher priorities when seemingly the whole world was arrayed against their fledgling nation.
Well, he certainly, yes, it was an unfortunate situation. He had a situation where all of Europe had been perverted by Christianity to, and also by the banking system takeover and a media takeover, very much like we have right now in most European heritage countries, sadly. And it was a dire situation. If he had more time, would he have come around to making everything pagan again? Well, I certainly think so, because one of the last things he did was write a beautiful Odinist poem when he was at the front. And certainly he was thinking along those lines. He was talking about going to Wotan's Oak. So he sought strength from our ancient pagan tribal roots and our ancient gods. You know, whether he was officially an Odinist or not, or whether he'd gone all the way on the spectrum to actually being an Odinist, as some of us have done, maybe not, or maybe he had, maybe he just hadn't gotten around to dealing with it because he was fighting a war, you know.
Right.
And certainly there's a quote by him from Table Talk that's very interesting. Let me see if I can. Here we go. Christianity is a rebellion against natural law, a protest against nature. Taken to its logical extreme, Christianity would mean the systemic cultivation of human failure. Now, that's a pretty strong statement to make.
That's what we see in the Christianized West, though, with affirmative action, where everybody but the most qualified will get the position, where people are elevated just for not being white or for being disabled. Or for just simply being a female, especially if you're a black female, so that the strongest, the most able are kept from getting the top positions. They're kept from being able to make enough money to sustain themselves and to have a large family. Instead, we have a program of dysgenics or malgenics, where those who really have no qualifications, they don't work very much, they can get on welfare, are able to have the most children. So it really is this war against excellence that is taking place, as you mentioned before.
Yeah, it's a war against intelligence itself, because people who are less intelligent are easier to control. So it's an attempt to mongrelize and destroy not just our race, but all races, you know, because if you're interested in diversity, and I've been saying this for years and cultural Marxists, but diversity is the in a scientific sense, is the preservation of unique ethnicities and cultures and things like that, not destroying them and making everyone into a sort of no identity, no racial identity, no cultural identity. That's not good for people. You know, what's natural and good for people, and what we see in our natural world, we don't see intermixing animals for the most part. I mean, there's some animals have been bred that way, but in nature, what we see is like with like. We see certain birds mating with that particular type of bird that's the same as they are, and cultures and people being preserved and growing and proving if they can, if they're able to. And there's certainly no advantage to us to destroying to any race. but we're particularly targeted because we're by far the most high-achieving race, and we're supposed to feel terribly guilty about that and destroy ourselves simply because we're high-achieving. Instead of continuing to achieve and continuing to exist, we're supposed to give way to those who are less high-achieving than us, simply because they're of another race. And we're supposed to have this cultural Marxist Christian mentality where we embrace that willingly, which is really sick. And some people do embrace that willingly.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to open up the phone lines here for the last half hour, 347-796-4488. Not the usual number, folks, 347-796-4488. I will also paste that in the chat at renegadebroadcasting.chatango.com. You can also find it at renegadebroadcasting.com. Click on the chat link. Folks, I would really urge you to call in if you have any questions for Shauna here. We've covered a lot of topics tonight, and there's a lot to dive into. Shauna, since we're talking about Hitler before and also about the lightning rod that is the chain around the tree and around the temple, and also the tree topper, which on the temple would be the steeple, which the Christians didn't realize, it seems. Let's talk about the lightning and the sun. Of course, Savitri Devi had written the book, The Lightning and the Sun, about Adolf Hitler, and showed how he embodied these qualities. But what can you tell us about the connection between the lightning and the sun, which we can see in the swastika, and how it relates to Thor in particular?
Well, it's really fascinating because these little ornaments that I keep coming back to, you know, clearly some of them are decorated like the sun and have the lightning rod above them, you know, the globe. The globe is a part of the lightning rod. It's put there. The glass globes are put there traditionally, because then if they break, you know, it needs to be replaced. So this is not just a decorative thing. This is an effective sort of form for it. So these two things are linked, the lightning and the sun, over and over again. And the idea is, for our ancient ancestors, which, you know, was obvious to me even before I discovered this connection that we're talking about today, was that the power of the sun was connected to the lightning, and Sunna is connected to Thor. You know, the swastika has the idea of Thor's lightning. It's a symbol of lightning, but also the power of the sun. And that's literally true, because the sun actually has these high energy particles that are sent to us by solar winds. And this is how the lightning is formed. And we actually didn't know this till recently, but it certainly looks like our ancient ancestors did, because it's been recently discovered that the sun causes lightning.
Very interesting. Well, yeah. We have a caller who just jumped on the line, but before we get to them, I want to stay on this topic for just a little bit more. Could you please tell us about how lightning is crucial for life to even exist upon this earth?
Yes, it has to do with nitrogen, because nitrogen has some atoms in it that are very, very tightly bound together. And we don't have sufficient energy in our bodies to use the raw form of nitrogen. We can't process it. So the only way that these bonds can be dissolved is if the nitrogen in the atmosphere, which can be struck by lightning, then they can be dissolved, because the lightning is so much more powerful and it's strong enough to unravel them, and then the nitrogen falls to the earth along with the rain, and, you know, mixes with the minerals, and in the soil, and then bacteria and fungi come, and they convert it into nitrates, which then later the plants can uptake nitrates, and they do. and some plants are even nitrogen fixers that actually help with this process. And then plants plants, you know, absorb this more absorbable form of nitrogen called nitrates, and then animals eat the plants, and people eat both animals and plants, and that's the way that we can absorb this nitrogen, which is so important because nitrogen is the, you know, building block of life. You know, it's part of our DNA itself, all the proteins. It's essential part of amino acids. You know, and without nitrogen, there wouldn't be any life on this planet. So the lightning really, it does fertilize the earth. It's not just symbolic, and our ancestors must have understood this.
Fascinating. Well, we have a caller with us. Hello, caller. Who is this, and what is your question or comment?
This is Gregor.
And, Gregor, welcome.
Yeah, great. I know both you, and I have emailed and corresponded with Sienna, and I just wanted to say what a great way to start Yule, this program. And yeah, wassail to you.
And you as well.
One of the things I find very interesting about Sienna's way of approaching these topics, which differs from, say, organizations like the AFA, and I'm not trying to hammer them by saying that, but that Sienna is not afraid to discuss and name the enemy of our people. And a lot of these organizations basically think that staying out of politics or not taking a political stance is somehow going to benefit our people, you know, but Odinia doesn't seem to take that stance, you know. In other words, why not make people aware of the enemy of our people? So anyway, you could maybe make some comments on that. And thank you, both of you.
Thank you. I certainly know what you mean by that. I see absolutely no advantage whatsoever to not warning our people about dangers, to not telling them things that they need to know, not telling them that they've been lied to about history, that they're being manipulated, that they're being enslaved by the Federal Reserve. Who owns the Federal Reserve? Who owns the media? You know, who the author of their misery is. And, you know, you can't solve a problem or deal with a challenge if you don't know who the enemy is. You know, and the more people who know that, the better. People should be shouting it from the rooftops if they love their tribe. And people do often present this as political. This is a tactic they're using to suppress any communication. You went on a Jewish group, no one would tell you that you weren't allowed to mention the Holocaust on that group. Certainly we should be able to mention Holodomor, and yet I was, you know, on that group you mentioned, I was thrown off, I presume, for mentioning the Holodomor. You know, that's me loving my people. If I were a Jewess on a Jewish group and I mentioned the Holocaust, everyone would be patting me on the back. So we need to love our own people and protect our own people and realize that we exist and we have a particular tribal identity. We must protect our people. We must protect our identity. And the truth about history needs to be heard by our people. If we don't know what's happened to us in the past, we can't deal with the future or with the present and change things and make them remake them in such a way that we can free ourselves and live abundant lives instead of engaging in the sort of situation where we have no homelands anymore, where we have no self-determination anymore, and where we're, you know, constantly subjected to just the most vile things in the media that anyone's ever seen. And maybe some people think that they have to engage in some kind of a cooperation of some kind by not mentioning it. But I don't see how that helps us. And I don't see how not fighting it helps either, because I think there are people who think, okay, well, if I go along with them, I'll be spared or something like that. But not only is that cowardly and disloyal and traitorous to our folk, which is a big deal, I think, very important not to be, you know, a cowardly traitor, especially if you're an Odinist or a folkish Asatru person. But it's also crazy, because I think the Jews, one thing I will say about the Jews that is positive, which doesn't happen very often, is that they probably hate traitors just as much as I do. And I hate traitors more than I hate the enemy, even. And if they think that they're going to be spared somehow because they've crawled across, you know, on their knees and betrayed our people, which is what they're doing when they don't allow open discussion of what is to our benefit, they're betraying us. Then, you know, that's what's happening in the real world, that they can put any sort of, a candy coating on it that they want to put on it. But the fact of the matter is that not telling our people the truth harms us and harms our side. And we have a side, we have an identity and a tribe that we need to protect. It's our responsibility to protect our tribe. It's our responsibility to act and agitate and fight for our own people. So that's my perspective on it, in short.
Great. Gregor, anything else?
Yeah.
Sorry, Gregor, anything else you'd like to add before we start to wrap up this broadcast here? Oh, it looks like you actually already dropped from the line.
Oh, okay. I think he said Vas Hael, so yes. He just wanted to hear if we had anything to say on that.
Well, can you tell us about Vas Hael, what it means, and what wassailing means, or wassailing as it is known?
Well, that's basically, in a way, it's two different things. I mean, Vas Hael is a greeting that we use, and it has to do with good health. And it also has to do with this lovely custom of going around the apple trees and drinking and making a libation, really, to the trees to try and increase fertility. You know, fertility, as we were talking about before, is such a repressed topic. But our ancestors had this beautiful custom of going around the trees and singing and encouraging them, because they considered the trees to be living beings, you know, rather than sort of things that were meant to be used and processed and that kind of thing. And they had a deep, rich culture, and it still survives. I mean, wassailing still survives in some places, such as England. There are wassailing ceremonies. I even think there's a few in America. And they take bits of toast and they sort of offer them to the tree. And the idea is that there's a symbiotic relationship between the trees and us, and that we can encourage each other. And this is just a ceremony meant to ensure the fertility of the tree. Asking the tree to produce, you know, beautiful, wonderful apple, life-giving apples for us. And it has to do with goddesses as well, you know, Idun and Pomona as well, the Roman mm-hmm. goddess. And Idun is Norse, of course.
Right, and those apples. An apple a day will keep that Jewish doctor away. You'll stay nice and young with those apples. Now, what about the sun? The Nordic people had respect for these living trees. But the sun, is that not also alive? We're talking about this holiday that is about the sun being reborn. Is this not a living deity that we see every single day?
Well, we have elemental gods and goddesses in our perspective. You know, we don't actually just sort of cut that out, that idea of pantheism or spirit and nature, as so many different, people who are of these Abrahamic religions do. There's sort of built-in antagonism towards nature. Of course, not all Christians have antagonism towards nature, of course, because a lot of Christians still have European attitudes, because it's built into us innately to be to love nature and to commune with nature. And some people even think that's part of Christianity, but it isn't really. If you actually look at what Christians...
Oh, yeah. Seems like the Christian doctrine is all often pushing nature as being Satan's playground. And yes. You even see this in the Jewish movie Antichrist, where the natural world is just viewed as being full of death and evil and, oh, it's scary stuff. And it's just you see it so many different times where it's kind of the city is the civilized, safe place to be, where nature is where all the scary, bad stuff happens. And yes, I understand that there are threats in nature, but it is that's the place where you're going to be able to connect with the old spirits, with the natural spirits as well, those elemental spirits that you're talking about. And I think that our disconnection from nature is what allows us to be fleeced so often, to be played for fools.
Yeah, it's there's truth in nature. I mean, that may seem a sort of basic thing to say, but when one is communicating with nature, when one is close to nature and living in a natural environment and looking at natural signals given to us by nature, one doesn't often go off track, you know. All of the things that nature provides for us are good and beautiful and wonderful things. And it's kind of like, you know, these Jewish religions are trying to repress that and control that and take control of that and to make that most essential primary connection that we have with nature itself bad. It's like
to sterilize it.
Yeah, it's a really destructive mindset. It's to be against nature. And
do you read signs from nature, whether it's animals or you're just rocks or plants or different things that you'll see outside in the natural world as being communication from the gods?
Oh, yes, I do, definitely. And I think there are a lot of people who think that way. I mean, I think maybe they wouldn't admit it necessarily, because being close to nature or seeing signs or indications in one thing or another, I mean, sometimes that's just your mind working and reminding you of something and you're figuring out. And it could be coincidental, but sometimes I think it's not. And when you see a sign, I believe that our ancestors try and lead us in the right direction, that they try and express to us things that we need to know. And I believe that our ancestors, for instance, and what we were talking about just now, are crying out for justice. About, you know, what has happened to us in the past at the hands of the Jews. I think that, you know, that that our ancestors don't want us to be destroyed in this horrible way, you know, both body and soul. I mean, if you look at, you know, things like Miley Cyrus, I mean, you know, it's become a joke, but it's so horrible, but you know, the degradation of our people that they're subjecting us to is so outlandish. and I can't believe that, you know, all of our ancestors and gods and goddesses don't wish us to escape from this, to free ourselves from it, and to have a normal, healthy life again. And so this is a good subject for the Yule, being reborn. You know, can we make the world anew? Can we make things healthy and normal and renew them in a European society, a truly European society, and leave all this terrible Semitic repression and perversion of everything behind? Well, I think we can. I think we can go back to what's natural and good.
Well, I do too. But Shauna, at this point in time, we're facing a situation somewhat similar to what Hitler faced. Of course, it's different in many different ways. But what I'm getting at is that many of our folk at this point are Christian. And I feel like we need them for this struggle. They can look back at their history and realize that even within their structure, which has all of these Jewish elements, there still are many, many anti-Jewish elements against usury and against Jews themselves. And many of their scholars have come out and talked about this. So I feel like there needs to be some kind of bridge that's made or some kind of coalition that's formed, like they had in National Socialist Germany, to deal with this problem, but not just on a national level, on an international level, because we are dealing with an international enemy. And I feel like we can start to influence some of these people through time to bring them back to their natural old ways. And I think shows like this that show just where their traditions come from are a good way to go about this, to show that we do have a lot in common, and those things that you love about your holidays are not actually because of the Torah, the Old Testament, but because they are based and they've been stolen from your European ancestors. What do you think about this?
Well, certainly, I think that whatever stage of deprogramming one is at, that there are certain things that we can hold in common, such as being against our people being racially exterminated or replaced by immigration that's not European in our own countries that we've built, and things such as that. I hope there can be some kind of cohesion, at least to that extent. But I confess I do worry about the anti-European culture hatred I see. And I think a lot of it is, promoted by some people who actually are trying to cause Christians to hate their own culture, even in the white nationalist movement. And they're able to do that because, as we were discussing a little bit last time at Samhain, more effectively, because they are they can just say, oh, it's pagan, and if it's pagan, it's evil. Well, everything that's pagan is European. So this is their way of getting European Christians to hate themselves and our own culture and our own people by saying it's pagan. And I just simply don't – well, first of all, I hope that European Christians can begin to see at least that, you know, that that's not a good idea to hate your own culture, because your enemy told you so, no less. So that's one thing that I feel is a big concern, because the Jews are hammering away at that. They're very well funded. They've got all sorts of organizations working at it in all different angles. They're doing a really good job at it. And I think we need to actively confront that and say, to deal with it and say, okay, if you're European, whether you are involved in this foreign religion or not, you should recognize that if somebody is saying, oh, everything that's pagan is evil and they're your enemy and, you know, they're running your organizations. These Jews are running these Christian organizations. They're running their finances. They're so involved in them. Then it may be something you want to think about. Is something that's pagan really evil? Because they really do think it's evil. I mean, for instance, this article I wrote today about the lightning rod, the golden chain, etc., which is an interesting scientific discovery, and it's not a pro-Christian article because I'm an Odinist, but I don't think I was too cruel to the Christians. I just simply talked about the takeover of our temples and the different psychological perspectives and attitudes and why I object to the non-European attitude and why I embrace the pro-European merit-based attitude. And that's just my personal opinion. So they've already been calling me a witch over this article several times. So that is the idea that if you don't worship the Jewish God, you're evil. And that's the end of the story. So in a way, you know, it's not really pagans who or of any variety who are creating this divide so much as it is In my perspective, I'm sure there may be some pagans who are too, and maybe some people even think I am, but they have a different, the idea is, how can we connect with these people? Are we going to connect on equal terms, on their terms, or on our terms? Mm. Now, on equal terms would be fine with me, but it's not fine with them. See, they don't want me to have an opinion that is in any way, shape, or form against the Jewish God or anyone else like me. And they've made that very clear. They throw Odinists out of groups. They throw Odinists off of, I was thrown off of the Uncensored True Tube, despite not violating any of the rules.
All I did was, Christian identities adherents hate you, don't they?
Yeah. Oh, yes. They hate me very much. And they made a video about me where they call me I won't say all the words that they call me, but for about 16 minutes, I mean, and I don't even know these people. So, you know, you have to be pretty extreme in your hatred of pagan European culture to do that, much less to post it thousands of times over the last few years. And so you have to really wonder why they're doing that if they're pro-white. Mm-hmm. Because clearly I'm pro-white, because you can tell that by what I do. I wouldn't be naming the Jew. I wouldn't be as our enemy. I wouldn't be talking about the Holocaust and how it's a complete lie and all of the other things I do if I didn't want our people to know it and if I didn't want us to survive. So, and then they must know that. So why are they attacking me? Because they put their Jewish God, if they're white, if they're not Jews themselves or employed by Jews, then they're attacking me because they put their Jewish God before the survival of our race, which is just what Christians did in the past, which is why they genocided the Saxons, their own people, for a foreign god, which is why they burned beautiful young women as witches for a foreign god, to obey a foreign god. And I'm sure that Jews were involved in manipulating that, but still, they have responsibility too, then and now. And if I think that Christianity is a primary cause of white genocide, and that we really can't afford to be religiously associated with Jews, and that's my opinion, and it is my opinion, and I say that, and that makes me an evil witch, well, okay, that's fine. I'm fine with that.
I hope that all the pro-whites can recognize that we can all stand around the Yule tree as a folk and leave the Semitic garbage elsewhere. And real,
I hope so too.
I would like to see that. I'd really like to see them recognizing the beauty that that they've been celebrating all this time that has been disguised with a Christian veneer.
It's a scary thing to do. It's like stepping up to the edge of a cliff blindfolded. If you're really used to something, what they don't realize is that all they have to do is reclaim the part. Instead of getting rid of the evil pagan part, which is European.
Which is what everybody loves to begin with.
Yes. Then what they need to do is stop obeying the Jewish God and embrace our own culture. And I would love to see that too, what you said. And I would love to see our people coming together and worshiping our own gods and together with our own traditions and just leaving all of that Semitic rubbish aside.
Could you imagine a major manger scene with Thor and Frey and Odin as the three kings there? Wouldn't that be great? We somehow we've got to make this kind of thing happen. I don't know. We'll think about that maybe for next year's Yule. Yeah. Shauna, it has been so great speaking with you tonight. Could you please tell our audience where they can find your work? What websites that you are promoting these days, anything else you'd like to wrap up with, and also things we can look forward to you doing in the future, what you've got coming up?
Okay, let me try and think of what I should mention first here. Our main website is odinia.org, and we also have vikingalthing.org, thinktribally.org, and odinist.org. But the main one is at odinia.org, and you can actually reach all those other sites by going to the tab that says Odinia websites, and there's links to them. And some of those sites are, you know, very much under construction. The furthest forward one is VikingOwlThing.org, which is a site meant to replace some of the deleted things from Freyja's previous site we had. So that's which has actually been restored amazingly because of some I agitated with Google so much that they actually restored it because they realized they were legally liable. They ripped off our religious site for a religious site that had only schedules and talk about our events as hate speech, if you can imagine, because being Odinist is obviously being hateful. So
being a European these days and not hating yourself, that is hateful.
Oh, being a live European, that's hateful too. Yeah. So anyway, they ripped it off for no reason. We had two sites and they ripped them both off. And that was so bizarre. And finally, they gave them both back because they knew I was going to sue them. And so that Viking Owl thing is the one that I'm slowly putting some of those articles there in a new updated form. And Odinia.org has the article that we were just discussing at the top of the post section. So if you just go to Odinia.org, it'll be there. And we also have a podcast channel on YouTube, Odinist Podcast. And I've been having computer problems the last year, but they're about to be solved. So if I get it get everything together in time, I'm hoping sometime around this Yuletide to be able to give you a second part to that Wild Hunt Yule podcast that you just heard a little bit of, the first one. And so that's what's going on now. And we're also exploring options for.
Oh, well, it looks like the call with Shauna actually did say dropped. Or maybe people can't hear me. Oh, that is unfortunate. Let us see if we can bring Shauna back on here to finish up what she was saying. Just one moment, folks. Well, if we can't bring her on, I think she got out most of the sites she'd like to promote. But folks, let me just take this opportunity to say thank you so much for being a part of Renegade Broadcasting this year. I really hope that you check out all of the great shows here on the network, some really fantastic material, and we have a lot more coming to you in 2016. If we are not completely shut down, as it looks like there are many attempts to shut us down going on right now, whether or not just server problems or not being able to access the sites from certain states, from certain countries, or from the workplace. Yes, RenegadeBroadcasting.com and RenegadeTribune.com have been heavily censored as of late. Of course, Hellstorm, the documentary, was heavily censored in 2015. I will be going over some of the major events in 2015 on next week's show, where I'll be doing a year in review. So you have that to look forward to. It looks like I can't get Shauna back on the line here, but I really do encourage you to check out her material, her recent article on the chains and the lightning rods. Oh, that is very fascinating. It makes so much sense when you really connect it all together. So, folks, I hope this provided you with something of a brainstorm here tonight. Shauna's saying that the call just ended. I'm going to try calling her. Shauna, yes, yes, you're back.
Hi. I don't know what happened. The call just dropped.
Well, you were closing out with promoting some of your websites and giving us your final thoughts here.
Well, I just want to wish everyone a Merry Yule. And hope that people will look into the astronomical and symbolic connotations of it and enjoy them. And maybe check out that new article and get in touch with us if you're interested in starting your own Odinist chapter of our organization by any means, or joining us and promoting our real religion. And if you have any questions, you can always contact me at odinia@outlook.com. Or you can also phone us at our Odinist Temple, although I do answer my emails more frequently.
Fantastic. Shauna, it was great speaking with you tonight. I really do appreciate it, and hopefully we'll be talking again soon. Vasail.
Vasail. Nighty-night.
Take care.
Take care.
Well, thank you so much to Shona, and thank you out there to the Renegade audience. Really do appreciate you all being here, and I hope you have a very productive end of the year here in this holiday season, and then moving on into the new year in 2016. We have much work to be done, folks, but let us take some time to celebrate our people and to have time with our kin and celebrate this season. Folks, I will leave you with some Yule music here. Be well.
Dark, hold it close. dreams of your soul and enter the night and you'll find the light that will carry you to your dreams. Enter the night, let your spirit take flight in the field of infinite possibilities. Enter the night and you'll find the light. Enter the night and you'll find the light. Enter the night.